Coming up on this edition of the Golf Digest podcast, we discuss Xander Schauffele's big win in Hawaii and talk about Golf Digest, America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses with Ron Whitten.
My God, my swing feels like an unfolding lawn chair.
Well, why do they even have one if you're not supposed to hit it there?
Because it's fun! We're having fun!
What is this, custom? Mine's off the rack.
I wish Tiger Woods was here to help me with this.
We'll do it live!
Welcome back to the Golf Digest podcast. I'm Alex Myers. Today I'm joined by Sam Wyman, Keely Levins, and Stephen Hennessy in the studio here. Guys, you know, we had a small break before the PGA Tour kind of resumed here. And, you know, I don't know how into it you guys were when it started, but certainly we got a lot of interesting stuff going on, some drama down the stretch, and of course, a great winner in Xander Schauffele at the Century Tournament Champions. I guess, Sam, what, you know, your overall thoughts on Xander's performance? 62, 11
pretty,
under.
Pretty amazing. The second time he's come from behind to win in the last, what, 2 or 3 months. The thing about Xander Schauffele, I was thinking about it, was he's kind of now done this where he's afforded the ability to be the under-the-radar guy.
Yeah.
You know, you do this enough where you no longer can be the under-the-radar guy. So not to suddenly turn negative on it, but what's it like when he's suddenly a guy, a featured pairing type guy that people are paying attention to? When he has a lead or is near the lead, there's this expectation that he delivers. Because right now, he's just, you know, thriving on this feeling like he's not under pressure. It looks like that to me, at least. In Gary Woodland had the lead. Rory McIlroy's in the final pairing. So Xander was not the guy people were paying attention to, and then he just lights it up on the over the course of Sunday. So really impressive, and I'm interested to see how he builds on it.
When do you think he's going to turn into, like, that name guy that you're looking at? Like, how many times does he have to win until we think of him like that? Because I feel the same way.
It's a good question, and Sam's right. I mean, everyone on Twitter yesterday, even before, as the round was unfolding, was talking about how underrated he is, and you kept hearing that. And some people refuted that, were like, oh, he was the PGA Tour Rookie of the Year. He's not underrated. I'm like, what does that mean? He definitely does seem to be a little under the radar. I don't know. Maybe he's not as flashy as some of these other guys. He also, I mean, it's incredible. He's won 4 events in the last 18 months, but two of them are really limited fields. Another one was not a huge event at Greenbrier. And then the other one was the recent WGC, but again, that's kind of a limited field. You know, it's 70 people, and it was in China.
In fall. Not a lot of people watching.
Right.
So
right.
Didn't get the attention it deserves.
So you're saying he's a fraud?
No, not at all. Because, and again, he's up to number 6 in the world rankings. You can't fake that. No, I'm a big Xander guy. As we know, you know, fellow Alexander like myself. But I think that he hasn't had a win. I think this will be his biggest win to the average golf fan, because it was on in prime time. He shot the 62. You know, it's a
he won the Tour Championship. I mean, that was.
Yeah, I guess. But even that, it was Justin Thomas won the FedEx Cup. It was one of those confusing things. You know, on the flip side, though, he has contended already in a handful of majors.
Yeah,
so it's not like
second at the Open.
Yeah, so it's not like he can't do it on the big stage.
He was in one of the final groups with Spieth.
Exactly.
Chance to win, but shot a 74 on
Sunday. Right, right. But, I mean, to Keeley's point, I mean, obviously, if you win a huge event, if you win a major, that jumps you up there right away. I guess you'd argue, well, you know, Bryson DeChambeau hasn't. Why is he a bigger star than him? But he's got all the other stuff
going on. Yeah, Xander's not causing the same ruckus that Bryson
and
is.
I think it's partly like a personality thing, too.
Yeah.
We haven't really gotten to know Xander. You know, Bryson has such a dynamic with his rules things,
right,
and all the scientific approach to the game. And Xander, you know,
he's just normal.
He doesn't.
Right.
Yeah,
he's super normal.
That's what he seems like.
Well, let's talk about Keeley's golden touch continues.
That's
you just
true.
You know, how long ago did
Thank
you interview
you.
Him, and how many wins is that for you now for recent Levins interviewees?
Yeah, Tiger, if you're listening, if I interview you, you will win again. I interviewed Xander right after the PGA, and then the swing sequence that we shot that day is running in the current issue, and then
amazing.
He won.
He won in the fall.
And
so
the history of this is, like, there's 6 or 7 other recent winners last year who you interviewed.
It's been going on for like a year.
She's
and
a star
half.
Maker.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's a star maker.
Serious.
Yep.
It's a thing.
No, it's very real. So you're welcome, Xander. No.
Yeah. You know, Xander, you talk about his personality, and Keely, you could speak to this. I mean, he seems like such a down-to-earth guy. In fact, he might still be. He was driving a, as he called it, scuffed-up Toyota Camry as of last year. You know, this was the reigning PGA Tour Rookie of the Year. He won the Tour Championship with over, $2 million payday right there. And he's driving around a scuffed-up Camry, and his reasoning was, well, my lease is still going on. Why would I end it? That's just, that was it. So I, you know, you got to love the guy. Keely, did you kind of get that vibe from him as well?
Yeah, definitely. He was like very relaxed and super patient with the whole like photo shoot process, which is, I mean, it's a long kind of annoying thing, I would think, if I were him. Like, I wouldn't want to have to like stand under the bright hot lights and deal with this stuff right after, you know, a long season and a big tournament. But he was like totally patient, you know, whatever you guys need, happy to be here. And, you know, he seemed super genuine. It was like, I don't know. And I wasn't super nervous around him too. Like, he gave off a really cool vibe. But yeah, no, big fan.
Yeah. Humble beginnings growing up in Northern California. And yeah, I think the sky's the limit for him. His game is impressive. He kills the ball off the tee. Pretty good putter. So, you know, wouldn't be surprised to see him contend again in majors this year.
I also like how, I don't know if you guys agree, his caddy, Austin Kaiser, looks like he's 12 years old. He's a former teammate of his at San Diego State. And I just was looking this up. He actually won the closest to the pin at the Players last year for the caddy competition on the Wednesday. So they're both, these two guys are in quite a groove with the four wins plus that in the last 18 months. You know, we mentioned Bryson DeChambeau for a second earlier, and he had another great week. But obviously, he was brought up a lot more for the new rules. Two different new rules, because first we had everybody talking about him leaving the pin in, which I want to get all your thoughts on, and putting amazingly well. He led the field in strokes gained putting for the week. Coincidence, maybe, but he did do it. And then there's the new drop rule where you have to drop from knee height, and he thought that was, quote, a bit absurd, and he looked a bit absurd when he did it. First, let's talk with the leaving the flagstick. And Sam, what, you know, is this going to be the new hot trend on tour?
I mean, maybe. I was going to say, do you think the USGA is quietly asking him to do this? It's like great, you know, great spreading
great
awareness.
Yeah.
Listen, we need people to understand what's going on. There's new rule 2019. Can you just kind of do a lot of weird things and make a big stink about certain parts? I guess so. Again, we had this discussion before about the flagstick thing, which is, you know, it really depends on whether aesthetically it works for you. You made the point that if it's going to help, you know, even a little bit, why wouldn't you do it? I guess this is all the more reason why more people would consider it. Certainly from a pace of play standpoint, it is a little bit quicker to just leave the pin in and not have to deal with it. I mean, we're talking about, you know, fractions of a second.
Right.
So I could see, you know, maybe a few more players on tour when they have a long lag putt considering it. Otherwise, you know, tour players especially are such creatures of habit, and they have their routines. It just doesn't seem like something that they're going to suddenly start doing en masse right away.
Yeah, I think it's something that, like, I hope I don't really care if guys on tour do it or not. I agree with you that, like, just because they've always played with it out, they're going to keep playing with it out. But I hope that we see casual golfers really take advantage of this, because I think pace of play is a factor with the pin, especially with, like, beginners, because they don't know where to put it, and then it becomes, like, this weird dance of, like, am I putting the pin in someone's line? It's just, like, another etiquette thing.
You know what I hadn't thought about, though, is that how often are you waiting in the fairway
and your
flag's out?
Like, I was just going to say that.
The flag's
yeah.
back in, we can hit. Now people can be just getting,
yes.
That's just getting hammered
really
with balls.
Josh Thompson texted me the other day. He said, what about if you're waiting, and how many people are going to get clocked by golf balls? And I said, no, I was like, I couldn't wait to bring that up. I can't believe you thought of that, because nobody has brought that up. It really is unbelievable. I mean, how often does that happen? A lot, where you're like, oh, the flag's in, go ahead. Now you're going to be killing people.
This is going to be an awful follow-up story in like a year.
It could be. Like. No, and another thing I will say with the pace of play, and you guys are right, in theory, it does help pace of play. It does help pace of play. But sometimes it's a little crooked. You're now going to check to make sure that the flag stick isn't is in perfectly.
I guess.
Aren't you?
Are you the average player?
Not the average player. Yeah. But, like, if it rattles out, I mean, if you're playing, like, any sort of a match, I mean, you might, because sometimes it's not put in right. Sometimes you can't notice that. If it's leaning one way or the other, you might say screw it. Because, you know, Bryson didn't leave it in on every putt, obviously. He left it. There were certain ones. I think a lot of that was wind related. But, yeah, no, so you got a couple potential problems there with, yeah, and people getting injured. We'll see. Also, what about, you know, Bryson already said months ago that it depended on the width of the flagstick. Obviously, the regular ones are these fiberglass ones that are thin, but you have the thick wooden ones. I wonder, is there like a booming flagstick industry?
Yes, I was wondering
that's going to take off if really courses like, you know, combating par and wanting to make their court, you know, fortify
their bifurcation courses. Of flagsticks to certain courses.
There's going to be like a bunch of new booths at the PGA show. They'll all like optimized diameters of flagsticks.
Well, but, you know, obviously there are other guys who refuse to do it. Justin Thomas says it looks ridiculous or whatever. I have a feeling Tiger would never do it because he's such a old school guy. But Steve, could you see yourself doing it? I mean, I am going to do it.
Yeah, I think pace of play wise, it's a big help. And on the longer lag putts, it might help, you know, if your ball is going to be going past the hole and the flagstick catches it. I mean, why not? I don't think it could hurt a hacker like me. I think on tour, you know, we saw some of the guys kind of making fun while they're playing, you know, Bubba hold out from the fairway and saying, oh, you know, see, I should keep the
right.
There's a lot of that, like subtle little making fun of the new rule. So it's going to be interesting to see how they kind of adapt to it. But I think for average players, it'll be a good thing if it's kind of embraced.
It's definitely added to, like Sam was saying, the buzz of just talking about this, talking about the rules, you know, talking about the strategy involved between different guys. And then now I'm seeing, you know, putts that rattle out, people are posting, like, would this have gone in if the stick was in? So it's definitely giving us more to talk about. And again, I mentioned earlier the new rule of the drop. You don't drop from shoulder height. You drop from knee height. It looks ridiculous. And this is another pace of play thing. They don't want you to drop from the shoulder height. It bounces away. You drop again. You end up placing it. Why not then just let us place it? From the knee, it's still likely to bounce away.
Well, because placing, you can manipulate the lie a little bit more.
I agree, but from the knee, you could still drop it and have it bounce away, and you still are going to end up placing it half the time.
Again, I don't know. I mean, I think for the average, how many players do you play with who drop properly anyway? So for average players, no one does it the right way.
Or you drop and then you kind of go, that's not a good lie.
Put up a little tough address.
I could have placed it if I really dropped this harder or whatever. Yeah. Well, anyway, I don't know. Are you a stickler with the drops, you guys? No.
Definitely not with the guys I play with.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's more of a tournament golf thing.
Exactly.
Right?
I only follow the rules when I'm playing in a tournament. I mean,
right.
with the pin, like, I don't putt with the pin in anyway.
Right.
Like, or I putt with the pin in anyway. This is really, Steve and I are sharing a mic right now. I want everyone to know. This is really throwing
me off.
Adding another,
it's so
another
brutal.
Level of confusion.
I'm in a different seat. This is like the most stressful podcast of my life.
Well, we definitely wanted to have Steve on today because we are discussing Golf Digest, America's 100 Greatest Golf Courses. It's our biennial, did I say that right? List. It comes out every 2 years. It is out now in the February issue. You know, got another shakeup at the top. Got Pine Valley back at number one instead of Augusta National. We have a lot of other stuff. Steve, you know, before we get into our chat with Ron Witten, who you work very closely with, what were your biggest takeaways from, now that you've been doing this for a few years, from this year's list?
I thought the most exciting thing to me were the new courses on the list, and all those new courses are actually really old courses. So Myopia Hunt Club is at 76. It's new. 79, Monterey Peninsula Country Club, the Dunes course, that gives them two courses in the 100 Greatest at 79. 89 was Sleepy Hollow, and 98 was Old Town Club. These are all courses from the 1920s and even earlier, and they're making our 100 Greatest for the first time ever, and I think that makes our rankings a lot more, probably the best ranking I've been a part of since I've been working with the 100 Greatest panel at Golf Digest, and I think it speaks a lot to the level of restorations around the country and that trend. You see Sleepy Hollow with Gil Hance's recent changes, the Dunes course of Monterey Peninsula undergoing a renovation from Tom Fazio's group, Jackson and David Kahn, Old Town Club with Corin Crenshaw. So that's the biggest trend that I think Ron Witten and I are seeing is not necessarily the number of new courses being built, because that boon has kind of stopped,
sure.
but it's the number of renovations at, you know, the best courses in America too. You know, Oakmont is constantly undergoing, you know, little tweaks and changes under Coren Crenshaw now, and they also were working at Shinnecock Hills where the U.S. Open was this year. So I think that's kind of a big trend to me, and mm-hmm. it's interesting to kind of see that play out throughout the entire 100 and entire second 100.
Sure. I'm glad you mentioned Sleepy Hollow, because I've never played it, but it seems like everyone who goes and plays it, because, and we're in this area obviously, says it's their favorite from this area, and this area is obviously stocked, so glad to see it get represented. I'm sure you've played there.
Yeah, it's one. Great, it's so much fun.
I mean, obviously.
you mean this week? Only once, but
no, anyone, you know, needs to put that on their list.
Yeah.
You know, it was number 101 last time and came into the 100 greatest for the first time at 89, but Gil Hanse studied, you know, the original architecture by Seth Rayner, and then Tillinghast worked there too. And the last two or three years renovated it in the 16th hole, which is the famous one. He reinstituted the thumbprint into the green at the 16th with the bunker moat surrounding
mm-hmm.
it. So it was so much fun. And it's kind of the trend that we're seeing of getting away from difficult being a measure of greatness and refocusing on fun and playability being more of a constitution of what architects are considering when building and renovating courses. So they're a good indicator of that, as are a lot of courses on the list.
Awesome. Well, yeah, hopefully I get out there sometime if anyone's listening. No. All right, let's get into our talk with Ron Witten. He discusses a lot more, so does Steve, about some of the process that goes into this list and about golf architecture itself. Have a listen.
Before we go on, let me talk for a second about Golf Digest Schools. Golf Digest Schools is our new cutting-edge video instruction platform, offering more than 250 classes on every part of the game and featuring the leading teachers in golf, from Butch Harmon to David Ledbetter to Michael Breed. Unlike the quick tips you can find across the internet, these are full game improvement programs meant to be followed step by step as if you were working with a pro. It's like Masterclass meets Netflix, but even better because there's the added promise of feedback. To sign up for Golf Digest Schools, go to golfdigest.com/allaccess and use promo code SCHOOLS to get 30% off an annual subscription. Again, golfdigest.com/allaccess and use promo code SCHOOLS.
All right, we're happy to welcome in our own Ron Witten, golf course guru, to talk about the America's 100 Greatest List. Ron, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
All right. Well, first off, you know, the new list is out. What feedback have you heard so far, and how does this year's, you know, feedback compare to other years when the list comes out?
Alex, I live in Kansas City, so I don't hear any feedback at all.
Okay. That's the reason you live in Kansas City, apparently.
That's smart.
That's correct. Yeah. The feedback has really been from architects who 10, 15, 20 years ago really felt that this was essential to their business, now not so much. And I think that's because there are fewer brand new courses being built, so that architects who build those don't get quite the publicity that they used to, and more because the game is all about remodeling courses, and architects who remodel courses and make it on the 100 Greatest don't get the press because most clubs want to feature their original architects.
Right. Mm. To what extent is this such a trademark for the courses themselves? And when, you know, course X falls from 50th to 60th, how often do you hear about that or hear grumbling about that sort of thing?
Oh, we hear a lot of that sort of thing. And both from members and from club officials who are always concerned if they drop, why they drop, what they can do to reverse the slide. other courses. I just got an email today from a course that a club that, whose course didn't make the 100 greatest, wanting to know what they did wrong. And my answer always is, you didn't do anything wrong. That there's only 100 spots, and it's a very, very competitive list. I think Steve can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we probably have 350 courses that are really in contention for those 100 spots.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, Ron, if you look at the points of and what separates the list from number 75 is Olympia Fields North Course to 101 Eagle Point, it's less than 0.5 of a point separates them. So, and that's a big difference from 75 to 101. So the level of greatness is high, you know, up to even the courses that just miss our second 100. So, you know, to just move down 5 spots is really not an indication of doing something wrong at a course, but, you know, it might be more of a virtue of more courses, you know, moving higher because of renovations and different other trends in architecture. So, you know, your point is a good one that the level of greatness in golf courses is just getting better because of renovations, and it's ultra competitive, and we see that from year to year.
That raises a question I had, which was when you talk about the narrow difference, you know, we're talking about fractions of a point. Mm-hmm. Why isn't there more volatility? I mean, it's almost amazing that a lot of the list remains intact from one version to the next, given that we're talking about, you know, 61.7439 or 7. Right. You know, 080. It's amazing.
Yeah, probably the reason is because we count evaluations on a 10-year period, so there's less volatility and movement year to year because it's over a longer period of time of just not every 2 years when our rankings come out. So, and that's by design because, you know, these golf courses don't change too much from every 2 years. And, you know, we don't want, you know, that much of a seismic shift, you know, just because a couple of panelists evaluated a course, you know, one way or another, you know, by a couple tenths of a point. So, and Ron, I think you would agree that that's kind of why, you know, you don't see that much of a change, especially near the top.
That and the fact that we now require 60 evaluations to qualify for the 100 greatest, and in 2021 we're going to require 75, so that each individual panelist who files another evaluation, I don't want to say their score counts less, it just takes more change of numbers for the needle to move than it did when there was only minimum of 30 evaluations. Five, when you had 30 and you had 5 new evaluations, boy, the needle could jump considerably up or down. You add 5 to 60 or 75, and it's only a slight movement. And that is by design. Mm-hmm. Statistically speaking, the more evaluations they have, the more accurate we feel our rankings are in terms of justifiable evaluations. But on the other hand, it's harder for a course to move up or down by just having 2 or 3 panelists come in every year.
Yeah. For example, pretty much every 100 greatest course has over 100 evaluations. Like a course like Bandon Dunes that gets played so much has over 300 evaluations. Pinehurst number 2 has 250. Even Pine Valley, which is ultra exclusive and private, has over 250 evaluations because our panelists are playing there as guests. And so that creates less of a volatility.
And which is why when you guys are soliciting panelists or looking for panelists, you're very rarely looking for ones in the New York area where there's, you know, all these courses have been played ad nauseum. You need these more remote locations where it's tough to get people to.
Right. So those courses in more remote areas are, you know, get the recognition that they deserve.
All right, Steve, I know you oversee the panelists, right, for the most part. Explain to people how you become a panelist, how many we have, and what kind of the whole process is. Because I think a lot of people just think you or Ron are sitting, you know, crunching numbers yourself. But
Steve does have a lot of logoed shirts.
He does.
Like the number of logoed shirts is commensurate to their ranking on the.
They're all paid for by myself out of my wallet.
Ron's not finding the humor in that at all.
But no, you're right. I mean, this used to be a panel of good players and officials in golf who got together every year at a U.S. Open back in the '60s and '70s and decided on the best courses for that year every 2 years. But we, since Ron Witten joined us in 85, we've instituted a panel of golf course evaluators, and we now have 1,400 panelists around the country in Canada who evaluate courses for us, and they're comprised of good players, so they're all mostly five handicaps or lower, and they have to represent a great understanding of golf course architecture and a desire to apply our scoring definitions to the courses that they play. So this isn't subjective. There's seven scoring criteria that our panelists evaluate courses on. It's not them going through one through 100 and just putting whatever golf course they think is best.
Right.
There's a set criteria that we establish. So that's kind of how all it works.
You know, that's a question for Ron, because you've been doing this so long, Ron. Like, when you're educating panelists about how to evaluate golf courses, what is one of the traps that you're trying to, prevent them from falling into?
The main trap is to set emotions aside. Most panelists coming in, they're so eager to express their likes and dislikes because they've played great courses in the past, and they get excited about playing great courses, and as a panelist, and we keep our first rule of training is that you're no longer a critic. You don't get to give us your likes and dislikes. What we want you to be is a judge, and that's where you objectively analyze each golf course and apply a set of rules, the criteria that we present to them for evaluation purposes. So they've got to be objective. They can no longer have favorite architects or favorite styles or favorite designs or favorite eras. All those things are tough for most golfers to set aside because, the game is one of emotion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the seven criteria, if you didn't mention already, it's shot values, resistance to scoring, design variety, memorability, aesthetics, conditioning, and ambiance. I mean, like you said, these shouldn't be subjective measures, but even shot values, how do you, like me speaking, which is why I can never be a course rater, because I can't separate my experience playing a golf course versus my evaluation of it. So how do you separate that, I hit a great shot into that hole, so it's a great hole? I mean, I got to think that has to happen.
Well, you've got to do it like an architect does. An architect who designs around his own game is going to design a very narrow spectrum golf course. So you've got to consider all sorts of players who are going to play that course. You got to figure all kinds of shot options on those on each hole. And as a panelist, you're asked to analyze not based on your own game, but rather how an architect expects a lot of different players to be challenged and yet find it playable. I should mention here a scoop for you guys that as of January 1st, we have a whole new or almost whole new evaluation criteria out there that we're training our panelists on right now. So shot values becomes shot options. Design variety becomes layout variety with little wrinkles or changes in the definitions. No need to go into a great deal of hype about that right now, because it'll be 2 years before it's implemented in 100 greatest. But that may see some change in the rankings next time around. Wouldn't you agree, Steve?
Yeah, for sure. And I think one of the biggest changes to me is the addition of a fun category to our rankings, which we won't use at first. But I think that kind of is indicative of course design as a whole. We're seeing a shift away from difficult being a measure of greatness, and our ranking is not meant to be a ranking of the best championship golf courses in golf. It's meant to be a measure of greatness in course design, and I think our addition of a fun category is meant to indicate to the industry as a whole that the shift in architecture and how architects are designing for playability and fun rather than just beating panelists or beating golfers up. You'd agree with that, right, Ron?
Yep. And I'll give you one other scoop while we're at it, and that is that to address that question of why courses don't move more drastically every 2 years, and we told you it's because we have numbers over a 10-year period. We are now seriously analyzing different methods of trying to weight present evaluations more than those that are 10 years old or 8 years old or 6 years old. And if we implement that in the 2021 rankings, which I think both Steve and I hope we can do, if we can work out the formula, that's going to have some impact on the rankings next time around too.
What was there a major reason for these changes that will go into effect? Were you hearing complaints about the system or anything like that?
Sure. We're this latest change was at a suggestion of a panelist who's a mathematician. Dean Knuth, who happens to be a panelist and has been our statistician for a long time, was the one pushing for us to get to 75 evaluations as a minimum for our 100 greatest. And to do that, we had to stretch it out over several years, because you can't ask private clubs to allow 75 people to come in every year, right, or every 2 years. And while it would be ideal if we could have the same panelists play all the courses every 2 years, wipe the slate clean and start over, that's not practical. So to do that, and yet we realize that, and it was, I mean, something we've talked about for a long time, that a course has changed over the last 10 years. There's very few courses that haven't changed just through natural growth and attrition and weather conditions and all these different things. So you want to address what the present architecture is like, not base your rankings on something that's 10 years old.
Steve, how, you know, if you're a typical panelist, how many evaluations do you do a year? And do you do an evaluation basically every time you play a round of golf somewhere, or?
Not every time they play. You know, if they're just on a buddy's trip and not really focused on the course and they're told not to evaluate the course because it's serious. And to Ron's point before, panelists are even told not to keep score when they're playing. And, you know, if they hit a bad drive, you know, they should drop a ball in the fairway and hit the shot that the architect intended them to hit, and even drop balls on both sides of the fairway to evaluate the different angles and options presented by the architect. But I would say the average panelist does 15 to 20 evaluations a year, and they're required to do 10 every 2 years. So when we looked at all the data this year, it was based on 70,000 evaluations of all of our panelists over that 10-year period. So, you know, it's a serious data set that these rankings are based on. And, you know, the numbers are the numbers. There's absolutely no editing of the points at all, which makes our rankings, you know, unique in that aspect. And it's why they're the most respected rankings in the industry.
And neither Steve or I has a vote.
Right. That's important to note. No, because a lot of people think that, you know, when this comes out, we're playing favorites or this or that.
Yeah, but and like, it's based off of, you know, where, you know, Ron or I got the best treatment. I mean, could be the farthest from the truth.
Right.
And it's worth noting that we haven't even talked about some of the results. I mean, obviously Pine Valley is number one. It's Augusta National and Pine Valley have gone back and forth every year, except for Pebble Beach was
2000 was the last time.
The last time. Pebble Beach is now down to seventh.
They were seventh last time.
Right. Yeah. So Pine Valley, Augusta National, Cypress, Shinnecock, Oakmont, Marion, Pebble Beach, National Golf Links, Sand Hills, Fisher's Island. I mean, this is an impossible question for you to answer, but is it possible for one of you to say, actually, I think Fisher's Island's a better golf course than Pine Valley? Can you, I mean, is that like, I'm just use as an example, like, can there be that opinion out there, even though the rankings consistently say those are the top two courses?
Sure. You know, if you look at number 10, Fisher's Island, and look at Pine Valley, only 6 points separate them. So across our seven scoring categories, that's less than a full point in each category. So, you know, realistically, a panelist out there could have ranked Fisher's Island higher than Pine Valley had they played both of them. So that's not out of the realm of possibility. And, you know, it's okay if they have that opinion, but they're told not to take that opinion into the courses that they evaluate. So
sure.
What was the biggest surprise for either of you of the top 10? Because obviously, yeah, the top two or three, I guess, seems pretty constant. Were there any surprises in the top 10? Maybe, I don't know, maybe Wingfoot's not in the top 10 anymore. Is that one of them? Or
Yeah, they're 11th now.
Okay.
I would say
that's probably a surprise because Gil Hance has over the last 3 or 4 years redone the West course along with the East course. And I think, you know, people are going to say, oh my gosh, it fell out of the top 10. Well, it fell by a fraction of a point behind Fisher's Island, which is another course that Gil Hance has worked on.
Right.
And when clubs call me and say, you know, what do we do? And I said, well, you need to talk to Gil, I guess, because he's working on all these courses. Seriously, there aren't any big surprises, I suppose, in the top 10 or even in the top 100, other than probably there were, I think, most of the courses that are moving up, and I pointed out Friar's Head is now number 15, and it's moved up. It's one of two courses that have been on the list for 10 years that has moved up every 2 years.
Hmm.
Out of all these other courses, there's only two on the list, that and Ballyneal in Colorado, a Tom Doak course. Everything else seems to have, you know, drops down a little, moves up the next time, drops down a little, and that sort of thing.
Hmm.
The thing I notice about these courses that are moving up is they're what I call right brain courses. They're they're by right brain architects who do these real spontaneous, minimalist, very natural sort of courses. And yet most of the golfers who play them are left brain golfers. They still like to get out there with their range finders and find exact yardages when in fact these architects expect you to play this course by feel and bounce the ball well short to feed it into the green and that sort of thing.
That's really interesting. Ron, let me ask you a question. You've been doing this for so long and you're the authority on golf course architecture. And I'm not just buttering you up when I say that. Is it possible for you to play a golf course without giving all, you know, so much consideration to a course's design? And can you put that part of it aside when you play, or is it such a thing where you just rather not do that?
No, it's an occupational hazard for me. And that's why I tell my panelists, you can't focus on your game and focus on the architecture.
Hmm.
It's one or the other. That's where tour pros were never very, were the few tour pros we ever had were never very good panelists because they have tunnel vision and rightfully so. They're trying to conquer the golf course.
Right. And that's like one of they say about. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm ADD anyway, but I tend to get distracted by so many things when I play around a golf in terms of what I'm observing in terms of the architecture of the course that I don't even bother to keep score anymore.
Right. Well, it's funny you were talking about how tour players don't make great evaluators. We always joke about Jeff Ogilvie, who is such a thoughtful tour player when it comes to golf course architecture, and we always say like it's his performance on tour might suffer because of the fact that he's thinking about design considerations when he should just be thinking about trying to make birdie.
Yeah. I wouldn't doubt that.
Well, is there any, you know, if you look at the 100 list as a whole, the ratio of new courses to old courses, is there anything to, has that changed? And also, if you are a new course, you're not precluded from getting on this list, right? You have to have enough evaluations and everything else.
Correct, yeah. You know, so there's a bunch of new courses in our second 100 this year. Streamsong Black made the list for the first time. Mammoth Dunes and Sand Valley at Sand Valley made the list in their first year of being eligible. Tiger Woods' course, Blue Jack National in Texas, makes the second 100 greatest, as well as the two other courses in Streamsong, I should say. So, yeah, as long as you hit that number of 60 evaluations over 10 years and 75 next time, then you're allowed to be on the list. But it's interesting to look at by decade how many courses are in, you know, and compare that to other decades. And it's interesting to see that, you know, the 1920s, the golden age of golf course architecture, still has more courses in the 100 greatest than any other.
Wow. You mentioned Tiger and you know, wondering, Ron, what you think. Is Tiger getting into the architecture game And obviously the Blue Jack National rating very well, and now this new exciting project right in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Is that do anything to kind of energize the just architecture in general?
No, I don't think it's the same impact that he's going to have that he's had on the PGA Tour, for instance. It's not translated into larger design fees for his competitors, if that's what you're thinking.
Right.
And in fact, I have no idea what sort of design fees he gets now. We all heard rumors about what he was promised in his first project in Dubai, but I don't know that he ever collected because that course was never built. To the extent that Tiger Woods being in that business throws a little spotlight on golf design, I'm sure that can help other architects, but they consider him a competitor. If you think the PGA Tour is a competitive business, boy, you don't know anything until you till you examine the architecture business.
Right. Yeah, but even more so, maybe getting general golfers to talk about architecture. I mean, I don't know how much, you know, Sam or I ever think about it. I think we're both starting to think about it more as we read more. Steve got me to take your course that you were doing with the panelists. That was very informative. I loved it. So, you know, stuff like that. I mean, maybe, you know, just Tiger is obviously a more recognizable name to a golf fan than Gil Hanse. Maybe that generates I don't know.
No, I think so.
See, I think Gil Hanse. I think Gil Hanse has a bigger impact because of his. He's a mainstay on a couple of U.S. Open broadcasts every year on Fox News,
and that's
he's he's talking architecture all the time. Tiger hasn't been talking architecture in the last 7-8 months since he started playing again.
That's true. What I was thinking, where Alex was going with it, and I think it's probably true, is that even on the most basic level, which is, Tiger Woods is designing a golf course. Well, what exactly does that mean? You know, what considerations go into designing a golf course? You know, all these things that I think a lot of average golfers don't really contemplate. Nearly to the extent that certainly that you and Steve do. So I think it does shed a little bit of light on sort of design considerations that might not otherwise be known about.
Yeah, and there's probably a level of interest to saying, hey, you know, it's a Tiger Woods course. I want to say I played a Tiger Woods course, and he has a course in Branson, Missouri, Big Cedar Lodge that's being developed, and the Chicago Municipal course that you referenced. You know, if that project goes through, that would be great for public golf in Chicago. So, you know, we saw Jack and Arnie, you know, get into course design more so later in their careers, and it'll be interesting to see if Tiger and Phil create that same level of interest after their careers are done.
Steve, have you ever, because I'm sure Ron did when, or maybe not, when it was back a smaller panel group, have you ever gone through a course that you've played after and just for the heck of it done an evaluation and seen how it shook out?
Yeah, pretty much every course, you know, I go through and create my own scores just to kind of see, you know, to go through the exercise to, you know, go have a further appreciation of what our panelists do. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
When we started our first panelist summit back in 2005, that was the year I got to play Augusta National for 2 days in a row. And on the flight down to Orlando, where we had our panelists get together, I filled out for the very first time an evaluation form on Augusta National. And I presented that to the panelists, not to tell them how to vote, but just to tell them, you know, just what thought processes I felt like I had to go through and that they should be going through.
Sure.
And the scores I gave were not flattering, and I caught a lot of hell about that.
Wow. Okay. So, well, yeah, I mean, obviously, Steve, I know you haven't played the top two, but Ron, you have played, obviously, the top two here. Are you, you know?
I think I've played all but two of the 100 present, 100 greatest.
Wow. That's great. Well, obviously, we talked about how Pine Valley and Augusta seem to go back and forth at least the last couple times. Which one do you think deserves the top spot? Or can I not put you on the spot?
Don't
like
put
that?
Him on the spot.
Well, okay.
Pine Valley deserves it because it got the highest score.
No, there you go. There you go.
Such a political answer.
Good answer.
It's like saying, do you really think Patrick Reed deserved the green jacket last year? Well, yes, he did. He shot the lowest score.
Very good.
It's true. Yeah. So, all right, Sam, what did you want to say something else?
No, I think it's really interesting. One thing I want to ask is when you're immersed in this process of, you know, start to finish, for both of you, what is the most stressful part of putting this ranking together, and when does that fall in the process?
To me, I would say is making sure every worthy course gets enough evaluations, and this is in my, you know, my doing this the last 4 years, this is the best list because we're not excluding a number of courses because they don't have enough evaluations, and that's because we've increased the size of the panel, and because of that, we've seen some courses that have never been on the rankings before. Myopia Hunt Club, you know, that's a mm-hmm. course that dates back to the 1800s that comes in for the first time in its history on our 100 Greatest. Same with Sleepy Hollow at 89. Yeah. It has never been on our 100 Greatest, and after a lot of changes by Gil Hance, it's on our ranking. Old Town Club, same thing. It had never been on our 100 Greatest. So to me, that's really rewarding and stressful at the same time as making sure we get panelists to these courses that are worthy of recognition. And that's why, you know, I think this is the best ranking that I've been a part of.
Ron, just before we go, I want to ask, you know, if you're a golf fan and you're trying to get into architecture and learn the basics, what would you suggest to someone to kind of, you know, get going on that?
Just start reading more about golf architecture and start studying courses as you play them. Every course, nobody sets out to build a bad golf course. Every golf course has certain compromises that had to be reached to make it, to create it. And as you study courses, you're going to find you'll recognize different methods of overcoming some obstacles and different presentations, different strategies, different wrinkles on strategies. As Pete Dye says, there ain't anything new in golf architecture. It's variations of other things. And if I were to tell any person who wants to study architecture, the first thing they should do, and this is kind of outrageous, but you ought to go play the old course of St. Andrews because that was that's the source of everything. Everything that's been done in golf architecture is either a response to or a response against the old course at St. Andrews.
Interesting. All right. Well, interesting stuff, Ron. Steve, thanks so much for joining us. Everybody check out the 100 Greatest list, which is out now. And thanks again,
Second 100 Greatest is also in the issue.
And Second 100 Greatest.
Second 100 Greatest will be presented online here in another week or so. And then in May, we have the Best in State. And in June, the 100 Greatest Public. Is that right, Steve?
Yep, that's right. Perfect. And the 100 Greatest and Second 100 are in our February issue.
Great. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Great stuff.
Thanks, Ron.
Talk to you later.
Thanks, Ron.
Thanks again to Ron for joining us. And seriously, I did do that webinar that you told me to do with Ron. It was very enlightening. I wish he did like a series of those.
I know. And yeah, the public would be into it too.
Definitely.
You know, it's interesting to get into the nitty-gritty of it. And a couple quick books to recommend would be Tom Doak's Anatomy of a Great Golf Course and George Thomas's old book, if you could find a reprint of that. And Tom Doak's Confidential Guides to Golf Courses are great too. So I think the level of understanding architecture, once you kind of get into it, like you said, it really kind of enlightens you and makes you think about architecture and the course you play differently rather than just, you know, playing with your buddies and, you know, trying to make a good score. It adds a level of interest, I think, to any golfer.
Yep. All right, let's get to some awards. We got our best one-day story, and this is a tie between two proposals on tour. You got Morgan Hoffman, Chelsea Colvard, and Peter Uihlein, Chelsea Gates. Morgan Hoffman, it's a great story because he said the proposal took his worst year of his life to the best year of his life. He was diagnosed the year before with muscle dystrophy. Did I say that right?
Muscular dystrophy.
And he's kind of put his PGA Tour career on hold for now, but he's happy. And I wanted to mention the Uihlein Gates one because it was very interesting. It was at kind of like a zoo, and it involved a stuffed animal, And it got me wondering, Sam, you've been married so long, you don't even remember how you got engaged. But these two youngins.
It was an arranged marriage. Yeah. Two tribes.
That's right. There you go. I wanted these two youngins, how does the, would the zoo proposal fly for you, Keely? And Steve, what, you have an interesting story about yours.
I was also confused by the zoo proposal when that was popping up on social media. You know, we were trying to break that down, figure out what happened. Personally, it wouldn't work for me. I'm not a big zoo person, so I would just be like a little on edge if I was in the zoo anyway. Right. I liked my fiance's proposal. We were out skiing, so
there you go.
It's a guaranteed yes from me there.
Right, there you go.
Yeah, and I think the key is like making it geared around something that means a lot to you too. So the fact that Uline did it at the zoo, you know, there's a good story there, and you know, great for Morgan Hoffman and his girl. And you know, the way I did it was at the beach where my fiance and I met. Brought her back there as a surprise and did it there.
I love how Steve is an expert on golf course architecture
proposals.
He's full service.
The best part about it, though, Steve is not mentioning, is that he had someone record it.
I know.
That's a pro move. Video. Right. That is, I mean, you have to be confident.
You
have to
be, right. All for the gram. True.
That's pro.
Very confident.
That could have been a viral video.
It could have been.
It could have been.
Watch this architecture geek.
Get denied.
Crushed. All right. Moving on, we got our this week in tour pros are just like us, and you want to say the Xander Schauffele top tee shot during his 62, which is even more incredible. He shot 11 under par, but no, I'm going with Kyle Thompson, who is the opposite of the Levin's bump. Unfortunately, we had Kyle Thompson on the Golf Digest podcast at the beginning of last year, I think, and he didn't have a great year on tour. He lost his card, and he's 39. He made a promise with himself that he would give it up if it didn't work out for him. And he stuck to it. And he posted a picture of him going to work on the first day. I think it was Wednesday, like when we all went back to work last week. And he's working in insurance now. And I wanted to point out, Sam mentioned Steve with the vest. He was wearing a nice vest. He had the vest with the button up. He had the office look. Steve, I mean, were you approved of that?
Yeah, very, very strong vest. You know, coordination with the long sleeve button down.
The architecture of the vest.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
I think I believe it was a quilted
vest.
Very strong.
Yeah.
There's seven criteria for evaluating vests.
Steve's got his Patagonia gray on today, fleece.
Fleece
I got one like that for Christmas, actually, but with sleeves. Yep. So it's not really a vest. But anyway. Yeah. All right, next up, we got our stat of the week, and this comes courtesy of CBS's Kyle Porter. And, you know, we always joke about when someone gets to four wins, we've done it on the podcast a million times, that they've won as much as Ricky Fowler has in his career. And it's still true, amazingly, even though Fowler's 30 years old. But this took it a step further. Xander won for the fourth time in 61 PGA Tour events. Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, Bryson DeChambeau, and yes, Ricky Fowler had three in their first 61 combined. Three wins.
Wow. Is that right about Jordan?
Yeah.
That's took a amazing. While to get cooking. 2015 was how many? So
yeah, he won the John Deere.
God, that's amazing.
Took a while. Well, Jordan probably has.
Well, he played in the end of 2013.
Yeah.
Right? And then 2014, he had, you know,
well, first of all, it could just be like a couple starts from Jordan and Justin, and it could be like 50 for Ricky Fowler because it took him a while.
Oh, combined.
It's
okay.
Combined. Yeah.
I see.
So anyway, those four great, great players needed a combined 61 to get to three. And Xander has four already. That's amazing. First of all, that's one out of 15. That's
a great ratio.
That's pretty
almost
good
Almost Tiger-esque.
Stuff. Yeah. Well,
whoa. All right. Careful. Here we go.
That's funny, though, you say that, because I was going to say we do overreact to everything, and now Xander's, you know.
The next Tiger.
He
surpassed Tiger.
Right. And actually, I even got taunted. I made a joking tweet about that, and a Twitter follower baited me into a bet. I now have a bet with some dude.
Oh, my God.
$50 bet, but I'm getting 10-1 odds. Xander wins a major this year.
10-1?
Oh, that's pretty good.
Well, so he offered, he goes, I'll bet you $50 that Xander doesn't win a major this year. And I'm like, no thanks. And he writes back, oh, come on, what are you scared? And I go, well, actually, the real odds are, and I looked it up, 10-1. He goes, fun, to make it interesting. And at that point, I couldn't back out.
Wow, 10-1 odds.
So I win $500 if Xander wins.
After he won?
I don't know.
Yes, I looked it up.
I bet those will go down.
How binding are Twitter bets, by the way?
Well, he said he took a screenshot. Well, then I went further. Apparently, he's a tour caddy. Who was interviewed in a Golf Digest story a few years ago.
Whoa.
Okay. But he's not a PGA Tour caddy, but he's on the web right now.
I hope he's not Xander Schauffele's caddy.
No, it's not Xander Schauffele's caddy, because he's too young to gamble, as we said. He looks like he's 10. So, no, but anyway, I have a bet with this dude on Twitter, and so I'll bring that up again. So, Xander, I'm kind of pulling for him to win a major now.
Come on, Xander.
10-1 and $50.
That's a good bet.
It's not
I
bad.
I like that.
Cool. Brooks, Tiger, DJ, Spieth, JT, they're all like 5-2.
Mm-hmm.
And this is 10-1.
Those are great.
So, after that, his
I was surprised.
Go to like
I thought it would be like more like 5-1.
Yeah.
I thought it would have moved down. But it said it was reflected as of today on Skybet, 10-1. So there we go.
Value.
All right, value. Speaking of value bets and bets, we have, let's finish with the picks for the Sony Open. If for people who aren't familiar, we are doing a weekly more beefed up gambling column/article, whatever you want to call it. Steve is kind of in charge of collecting, putting it together. We have a couple experts from DraftKings and FanDuel. We also have a tour caddy, Anonymous, mm-hmm. who's giving a pick every week. And then, you know, Golf Digest editor here or there jumps in, makes a pick.
Man Analytics, Lou Riccio as well.
And yes, a statistician, Columbia Lou Riccio. That's right. Dr. Riccio.
Yeah.
So anyway, check that out. But these are just our more off-the-cuff picks. They're coming on a Monday. Steve, I'll let you start with Sony Open.
Sure. So Sony Open at Wailea, very different than Kapalua. It's a very tight course, you know, tough driving course. So if you look for what portends success there, it's – you know, hitting the fairway and keeping it in play, it's usually one of the most difficult driving courses. So on that note, you know, Justin Thomas was driving it great at Kapalua, you know, finishing the top five, and he's won, obviously, at the Sony Open, shot 59 here. So, you know, he's the betting favorite and an obvious pick, but I'm going to go with him.
Healy?
That's a dagger. That was my pick.
That's all right. Double it up. It's JT.
No, it's fine. Let's go with – oh, you have the odds up. Look at this.
Scientifically based.
Yeah, my phone.
Let's go with –
nice. I was thinking of Leishman. He's right
oh, there you go.
There.
Leish.
There you
Beauty.
Go.
All right. Yeah, no. I like Leishman a lot. You want to talk about
– Likes him a lot.
Yeah.
Didn't like him till 5 seconds
ago. 5 seconds
ago?
Didn't like him at all? Now I'm all in. No.
Okay.
Right. Ball striking champion.
Okay.
Love him.
Leish. Sam?
I was speaking of ball strikers. I'm going to go with Matt Kuchar.
Oh.
Coming – got off the – got off the what's
Mayakoba
it? Got the monkey off his back,
yeah.
So he's back winning. Great, great ball striker. Not terribly long, but doesn't need to be at that golf course.
Yep.
So there you go. That was decided 10 seconds ago. So
there you go.
But Leishman was a good pick. His
Thank
first
you.
Tour win was at the Sony.
Healy knew that. She just didn't want to brag about it.
I just want to make sure.
I don't
want to
like
knows.
Flex all over you guys like that.
Subtle flex.
All right, I think that Bryson is going to win because he. You know, the flagstick mojo, everything else. I wanted to continue. He's right there. He's on his way to getting to number one in the ranking. But my pick, because of the betting wise, I like the odds. Brant Snedeker. Steve mentioned this is a much different course than Kapalua. It's not a, you know, a bomber's course. It actually, if you look at some of the names who've won, a lot of great putters have won here. And Brant Snedeker is a runner up here, and he's 40-1 odds. So
great
I'm going
value.
A little down there. Exactly. I'm going more for the value.
Typically plays well in the wind too.
Yep,
he's won
big win
Torrey
guy.
Before,
yep, so. And he's you know he didn't play great at Kapalua. He was T22, but he's already on the Hawaiian schedule. He doesn't have to adjust and everything.
His time
like
clock
that.
Is adjusted
right,
already. I
right,
like that.
Right. So there we go. Brant Snedeker and Xander Schauffele is going to win a major this year. I'm going to be rich. All right, guys. Thanks for joining us. Thanks again for Ron Witten for joining us as well. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done so already. And check back next week to see who our guest is.